So I guess I see that more as a kind of empathetic response. But as I was worried about casting a human image over the fruit, I guess that's where the recipes came in, to restore it to fruitdom.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Kate Lebo, poet, essayist, and pie lady, whose latest book, The Book of Difficult Fruit, is a book that defies genre. Part memoir, part natural history, part cookbook, The Book of Difficult Fruit allows fans of Pie School and Pie and Whiskey an energetic, playful, but often difficult look into the life of one of the Pacific Northwest's favorite bakers. Kate, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me, Lauren.
I want to talk first about magic. In The Book of Difficult Fruit, you write about sympathetic magic, imitative magic, and contagious magic, and these all appear in a single chapter. But you also talk about witchcraft and spells in relationship to recipes and cookbooks, as in they are, you know, part spells and spell books. And those mentions were really interesting to me. For our listeners, then, what do you find magical about fruit?
What's difficult about talking about magic in general and the magic of fruit is I think it is beyond words. I think the way that I covered that in The Book of Difficult Fruit tended to bring up instances of what I thought was magic. So, for example, very early on, I talk about recipes being a kind of spell. And what I mean by that is the way that spells are just as bossy as recipes. They're written with the same grammatical structure. They tell you to do something. They promise a transformation if you follow certain steps, say the words correctly, or stir correctly, etc. So I guess I was seeing, making a connection between the grammar of these different, you know, types of writing and seeing, I guess, because of that, the similarity in the way that they were written, a similarity in their outcomes. Something that's really important to me in thinking about food is magical thinking. And the ways that magical thinking around fruit, for me, makes me think of it as medicine, makes me also think of it as a very quick and very deep way to connect to any landscape I'm in. I think as I've attuned myself to fruit, I've become more attuned to the natural world, regardless of where I am. Fruit is where animals and plants intersect the most. Of course, it's something a plant produces, not necessarily for an animal's consumption, but an animal will come along, eat it, enjoy it, spread the seed elsewhere, and keep that plant going. So it's part of how we need each other.
Mm-hmm. You're speaking, and I'm thinking of the idea of entanglement, and it's a word you use in the book. In fact, in one of the book's notes, which sit at the beginning. You write, here, fruit's culinary, medicinal, historical, cosmetic, and cultural roles show us where what nurtures and what harms are entangled. And then soon after, in an essay about the aronia berry, A, you write, this relationship between plant and human parts is underpinned by a shared understanding between healer and patient that the human body doesn't end at our skins, but extends into nature. That what is in nature is also in us. And I was reminded here of Karen Barad, I think you pronounce it. But can you talk a little bit about this relationship between humans specifically and nature and how that relationship is a thread you pull on throughout the Book of Difficult Fruit?
You know, I think I'd have to start with talking about being alienated from nature to a certain extent. Or if not alienated, I grew up in a suburb which had been carved out of a natural area in Northwest Vancouver, Washington, which meant, I think, means that my psychotope, like the geography that made me, makes me really sensitive to this line between where the sidewalk ends and the bramble begins. And as I think, because I lived where the sidewalk was and ventured to where the bramble was, I had a sense that nature was elsewhere. And that where I lived was something that destroyed nature. And there was ways that we brought nature back in close to us to where we lived through gardening. You know, my parents had, well, we had blueberry bushes. We had a whole bunch of different kind of fruit-bearing things in our yard. And those were chores, of course, as a kid. And now when I think back on them, they seem like pots of gold. But I think within the book, the act of writing the book for me and the things that I studied in order to write the book were attempts to become more rooted and more connected with nature in a way that felt authentic to me. So, like, I don't really actually like to go outside that much. I don't like it when I'm hiking and a plant touches me without my permission, you know? Just like, I'm always just looking at my feet because I'm assuming I'm going to trip, and I do trip. So though, you know, I grew up in the Great Northwest, and I'm not someone who just wants to go out in it. I like to be inside on the couch with a book reading about the outside. It's through food and through cooking that I found that connection, and I wanted to offer that to the reader as another route. I think we tend to think of, or I had tended to think of cooking as something separate from nature, when it's indelibly tied to it. Of course it is. And the way that we encounter our ingredients is often divorced from nature, but they did come from there in some way or another. So when I'm writing about foraging or I'm writing about trying to find a particular fruit, like an ume plum, that isn't grown in that many places in Washington State, or when I'm trying to find a durian, which is grown in Thailand and has to be shipped over here. I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about is because we live in a time when you can really have anything shipped to your door, when any material is available to you, what is the value of kind of limiting yourself to what's in your backyard, what comes to you accidentally, what comes to you through relationships, rather than what comes to you from an Amazon shopping cart.
Mm-hmm. This idea of entanglement can be almost theoretical or philosophical even, but in a sense, this is actually the book's central metaphor. And metaphor is something that you weave really delicately and beautifully throughout the book of Difficult Fruit. There was a part in it early on in the book where you're writing about another book, one that was written in 1907 about plant breeding. And you write, "In the training of the human plant, a noxious work of supposedly good intentions, we see how it can be dangerous to compare people to plants, how taken to their extreme logical conclusions, such metaphors become, as they always half were, inhuman." And I know that you are not saying, you know, my aunt is a maraschino cherry or my ex is a plum. I know that that conflation is not, you know, one-to-one there, but these essays do seem to be dealing in the lyric, in a sense of their proximity, the way you use proximity.
Definitely.
To talk about these things.
That's the word that I would pick. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. So tell me about, and I hope you understand where I'm kind of heading or trying to pull from you here, but tell me about your ethics of metaphor, how your own ideas about this metaphor of entanglement sort of play a role in the book, and with how much ease or turmoil you use this metaphor.
That's a great question. And I wouldn't think of it as an ethics of metaphor, though I think that is an apt term. I'll have to think about that more. Because as you were describing, when a plum suddenly becomes, an ex-love, when a dear family member just becomes a quince, it really narrows, you know, it takes the metaphor and makes it pretty dull. But what I hoped, I guess, was through the weaving of many different ways of knowing about each of these fruits. That's how I was thinking about it as I was constructing the essays, is how do I get ethnobotanical knowledge in there? How do I get cosmetic, historical? But then also the personal is a deep source of story for me, and really is I want to understand myself, conflicts that I haven't been able to put words to, and the entanglements of relationships. I was hoping that by putting those situations in my life next to the qualities of plants and fruits, these fruits in particular, I might be able to disentangle them in my mind, at least understand them a bit more. I hoped that these two separate entities, when metaphorically related, would resonate.
No, I really loved the way you did it. And I'll be curious to know what your thoughts on this are. But, you know, most recently, there's this idea of the millennial and the houseplant and how the millennial specifically, but certainly other generations too, they nurture houseplants as though they were children that they do not have. And so I'm really interested in that metaphorical space between human and the natural, whether it's a houseplant or something that occurs naturally that you're foraging, for instance. But yeah, when I'm speaking to this ethics of metaphor, like, I'm really curious about, you know, to what edge or, yeah, to what edge do you go?
Well, and I think, maybe another way to talk about it is to bring the recipes in. So each of these chapters ends in a recipe. And that's fun. But structurally, something that was important to me about those recipes was the way they would conclude a chapter that had dealt with a fruit metaphorically and lyrically, had made that fruit abstract in a certain way or emotional in a certain way, had made it something other than itself, and bent that fruit to my purpose to understand a story I was trying to figure out. The recipe then, concluding the essay, would return that fruit to itself. It would be the material, the reproductive organ of the plant that it always was, and we would get to use it. Just in a physical, concrete way. Again, I like this. I don't know necessarily how to address that to your idea of ethics, except that it felt important to me as I was considering also questions of anthropomorphization. That there, you know, there's been questions or comments made, ideas, books. I don't know. I'm hearing from somewhere that I'm not supposed to apply human characteristics to plants and animals, and that is a colonial instinct to do that. I've heard that criticism as well, and I hear that. But then I also keep thinking, how else will I become interested in this plant? But the ways that I feel it is similar to me. The ways that I recognize its qualities are like my qualities. So I guess I see that more as a kind of empathetic response rather than a casting my image over the fruit. But as I was worried about casting a human image over the fruit, I guess that's where the recipes came in, to restore it to fruitdom.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I mean, I think you actually, you know, you aren't anthropomorphizing, really. And even if you are trying to find those empathetic moments with fruit or with the natural world, I think you've done so with proximity. You're not saying this is that or these are the qualities even that I'm seeing. There are, you know, certainly parallels perhaps, but I think it is that proximity where the reader is reading not only about the history and the etymology of a fruit, but also about your history and, you know, the relationships that you've had and lost. And then, yeah, then culminating in these recipes at the end. You know, and to give listeners a sense of what we are talking about, I feel like I want to have you read an excerpt from the book. Something from the
Should
book?
Should I do cherry or
fruit?
Zucchini? We could do poison,
I mean,
or rot,
choice,
actually, is a better question. Poison or
Ooh,
rot?
Let's do rot.
Okay, that's zucchini. Yeah. So this is the last chapter in this book because it goes from A to Z, of course. All right. Zucchini flowers open in the morning and close by noon. You can pick them at any time, but trying to open a closed zucchini flower is a delicate, difficult task, frustrating to a degree that it will seem expedient to take the short route and rip it open along one side so you can stuff it with goat cheese and herbs. I can tell you, having lost my patience this way, that the loss is merely aesthetic. I planted two zucchini last year, one too many. Any zucchini is too many zucchini, my husband Sam says. The recipe for this chapter should be stop pretending there are recipes that rescue zucchini. I like zucchini. I like knowing that of all the seeds we've planted, this one will definitely overwhelm us with our success. I plant two on our last day of average frost in the raised beds my father built over a cinder block jacuzzi foundation in our backyard. Each morning after, while Sam makes our coffee, I slip outside in my nightgown and bare feet to inspect the soil, see what's up. Our backyard is small, with shared wooden fences on either side that divide us from our neighbors' equally small yards. To the west is Earl's Island of Green. To the north, a rutted alley. To the east, a mud pit where the neighbor's German Shepherd runs in circles all day. Max hears me on the garden path and lunges at the fence, barking his head off until he remembers the sound of my voice. Max, it's me, I say, as I say every day. Max, for Christ's sakes. Once he calms down, I hold my hand out for him to lick and nuzzle, hoping that tomorrow will be the day this gesture helps the dog cease to guard my own garden from me. As each new sprout emerges from dirt, so does a new threat. Cutworms, onion maggots, aphids, weeds that resemble food plants and trick me into nurturing them. Too many sprouts too close together, demanding a choice between what will stay in the ground and which will become compost. Powdery mildew, rust, and my arch nemesis, the earwigs. They hide in the folds of rhubarb leaves, between daisy petals, beneath hollyhock buds. They emerge at night to chew everything tender to the ground. I wage war on them with diatomaceous earth until I read that this white powder might also kill bees. Then I pour soy sauce and cheap cooking oil into canning jars and bury the jars in garden dirt up to the rim. Earwigs, attracted to the savory scent, wander in and drown. When they multiply faster than my traps can handle, I kill them by hand. I need Sam for this part of the battle. After dark, we take a flashlight and a wad of paper towels to the garden and hunt for earwigs, thin ovals the length of a paperclip, brownish, blackish, reddish, with pincers that turn salad into lace. Smashing them requires a quick snatch calibrated to spare the delicate plant beneath the bug, then a hard pinch through the paper towel. Earwigs' exoskeletons are strong. If we muffle our fingers in too much paper, they don't die. A garden is made of hope, wrote W.S. Merwin near the end of his life. It cannot be proven, nor clutched, nor hurried. Whose hope? Whose hurry? As we coax this garden into profusion and plenty, our produce aisle and our sanctuary, opportunistic organisms that lived here before us reassert themselves. I keep the earwigs in check by paying obsessive attention to their hiding places and midnight buffets, but as I pluck them from their suppers, I also crush nasturtiums, baby kales, clematis vines. Cultivating this landscape does not make me master over it, which is what Merwin meant, I think, when he named the difference between what the gardener hopes and what she reaps. The difference is not failure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with poet, essayist, and pie lady, Kate Lebo. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
And in spite of being about fruit, which, you know, often delicious or beautiful or helpful, this book is difficult. It's about loss and grief. And so I'm wondering if you can explain that relationship, like this dichotomy of, the production, the recipes, with the loss, the grief, these ideas of failure that you just mentioned, and other emotions like shame. This book is full of those very heavy and hard to deal with emotions.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's two ways to answer it, and I'll do the easy one first, which is when I don't know what else to do, in the kitchen, I am always master, even when I'm failing. I can always just make it again, I guess. And that practice is something that is woven into my writing practice as well. So cooking for me is something I do that can satisfy me when I am not writing the way I wish that I was writing. And it's also something people know how to receive it. And it's an easy gift to give. And I need that when the rest of my artistic ambition, I think, is towards trying to write things that we can't say or shouldn't say. So that's one. That's one way to think about it. I think another is I'm interested in fruit just because when I see it, like something leaps in me toward it. And it's this nameless just joy. I love it. And I want to feel it and I want to do something with it. And I've got an appetite for collecting that resource, the fruit, and processing it and putting it away. And just the whole process of that is really, really satisfying to me. And I guess as I was trying to write about fruit. What helped me find the story in fruit were moments from my life when I was very confused about the relationship between nurturing and harming. And harming might even be just too, that might be too extreme. I think fruit makes me think a lot about the way that bounty and creativity and nurturing and making things can start out beautiful and positive and this kind of wonderful burst of energy, and then can become just a giant chore, mess, problem. You know, like when you're overwhelmed with an Italian plum harvest, which is what's happening in Spokane right now. It starts out really fun, and then you're like, wait, what happened? And I guess that rotting fruit in the grass, for me, was an image that I thought would help me understand these moments in my life where I thought the way that I cared for people was creating a healthy and strong relationship, and it wasn't. And it was perhaps a impulse that I was leaning on in order to feel loved. So that's one of them. If we're talking about my romantic relationships and some of my friendships, I think that that's true. But I also talk a lot about family relationships in there, and I think that's different there. There, it more has to do with my mom has chronic pain and has always had chronic pain since I was in her life. But, you know, I've watched her as a child, as a young adult, as an adult, try to heal herself. And she suffered from migraines and would go to doctors and be told it was all in her head. This was in the 80s, you know, and there still wasn't an appreciation for how these migraines were happening physiologically. And her frustration and her attempts to heal herself are something that just seared themselves in my memory. And she often used food, and she often used healthy food, or what seemed what we would call healthy food. It was healthy food, but I think at some point the burden of it becoming medicine kind of broke the magic that made it medicine and became sometimes, I think, something that she would eat because she was afraid of being in pain. And so trying to untangle that, the way that food can be medicine, but food also is not necessarily going to cure us. It isn't, it hasn't been in my life the answer to my ailments or my family's ailments.
Yeah, and in the Book of Difficult Fruit, many of your anecdotes do have you mining those histories with your mother and the ways in which she felt food were healing. And even the way that you, it seemed to me, now feel
definitely
that food is healing.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what the research process was for you. It sounds like you have like a very long history of that knowledge, or that knowledge has been kind of brought with you into your adulthood. What was the research process like?
Sure, that's a fun question. You know, I got really interested in the way that what I know about food, what a lot of people, the way they know food is kind of through rumor, through common knowledge, through things they picked up from the Food Network, which was on in the other room. And I realized early on as I was writing, once I started doing actual research, that what I thought I knew about very familiar foods, I had inherited from somewhere, and some of it was totally made up. Some of my early research when I was being lazy was on Wikipedia, right? What I found by looking at Wikipedia, and I decided to make this part of my practice, is I would go to Wikipedia first, not because it is a totally trusted resource, but because it is a place where I can find rumor. And it is a place where I can find a bit of folklore about these foods. I think the folkloric elements of a food, the rumors about a food, what your grandma says the food can do, what your mom and your dad, you know, all of that is as important as what a food encyclopedia or a medical journal will say about the food. I think it's part of the food's flavor and personality and history. So I would start by trying to, I guess, cast my net and see, you know, what are the lies people have been telling about this thing? And what can those lies tell me about what they hope this food will do for them? I'm exaggerating when I say lie, but like Aronia is a good example where it's being marketed as this, you know, miracle fruit antioxidant thing, which is great. I'm sure it does have antioxidants, but that's part of the magical thinking we were talking about earlier, to imagine that you can extract nutritionally beneficial elements from a fruit and feed them to yourself like it's a pill. That isn't how it works at all. A lot of the claims, the kind of magical and health claims that I would find about fruits could easily just be woven into the advice of eat a healthy diet. And I loved that. I loved that we have to kind of gussy it up and make it magical and or make it medical or whatever, just whatever it takes to get us to eat more plants and less, you know, animals and sugars. I wanted to also mention that at the time I was writing this book, I was working for the Spokane Academic Library at Washington State University in Spokane. I had access to all these fantastic medical resources, plus WSU's extensive archives. So I got to go in, it was like kid in a candy store, and just see what's there. So that's also an element. And again, it was important to me because I guess when it comes to food, food is an easy way to talk about all the different ways we know about something. It's kind of a low stakes way also to encounter the things that we get wrong about something. And I hoped within this book to mix all of those different things together into a web.
You know, one question that I ask authors is, what do you know to be, or how do you define the American West? And I want to change that question a bit for you, Kate. From you, I'd like to know, what does the American West taste like? What does it smell like?
Well, it's definitely smoky. What does it taste like? I mean, a huckleberry pie. That's the most obvious answer, and I think it is the truest answer.
I mean, yeah, even in the book, you write, to all of us who live in huckleberry country, whether we pick our huckleberries or buy them for, what, $90 a gallon, they taste like home. I think that's so true. I always like to ask the authors that I talk to or who I talk to if they have any books that they would recommend to our listeners, either to read before or after this book of yours, or just in general, if you have any great suggestions for listeners.
Yeah. I loved and was very inspired by Katherine Nirenberger's The Witch of I. She writes about the doctrine of signatures in a way that really taught me about magical thinking and the doctrine of signatures and the way that I could use that idea to think about the relationship between food and medicine. It's just a great, dense, beautiful, weird book. So that's one. Another one would be a book by Lisa Wells that came out this summer. It's called Believers, Making a Life at the End of the World. And Lisa's just, like Catherine, just a great writer, great sentence writer. So there's, you know, pleasure in just being with her voice. But I think what's remarkable about that book is the way that she tries to understand the enormity of climate change through the actions of individuals who aren't necessarily in power, who are not, you know, Bill Gates, who are not Greta Thunberg, but are in their lives coming up with not even solutions to, but just ways to live and make a life when we feel the apocalypse coming down on us. Which sounds depressing, but it's not somehow.
Kate, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been so fun. Thank you
for the so fun,
intelligent, lovely questions.
You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoge and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.